Good morning. It's 9:01 a.m. I call this meeting of the Investment Committee to order. Klaus, would you please take roll?
Chair Doan.
Or does someone else take roll?
Chair Doan.
I hear. Here.
Vice Chair Scotto. Regent Carvalho.
Here.
Regent Goodman. Regent McGrath.
Here.
We have a quorum. Ex officio roll call. Chancellor McNair.
Here.
CFO Vitone.
Here.
Mr. Garcia. Mr. Densler.
Here.
Advisory roll call. Mr. Lewis.
Here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have a roll call, or you have a quorum.
Thank you. Regent Carvalho, will you please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Yes.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, justice for all.
Thank you. I will now move to agenda item one, public comment. For those who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter meeting ID 992-8475-3091 and passcode 555555. Is there any public comment at GBC?
Good morning. No public comment.
Okay, thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Las Vegas?
None in Las Vegas.
Thank you. I do not see any public comment here in Reno. SCS, is there any public comment on the phone?
No callers at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll move on to agenda item number two. The committee will consider approval of the September 30th, 2025 meeting minutes. Is there a motion or is there a discussion or a motion to approve the minutes?
I will move to approve the minutes. This is Regent Carvalho.
Second.
Thank you, Regent Carvalho. Thank you. We have a motion by Regent Carvalho to approve the minutes and a second by Regent McGrath. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
I vote aye as well. Opposed? I don't think there's anyone left to oppose. Minutes pass. So chair's report. I don't normally have a chair's report, but today I'd have an introduction to make. I have requested an advisor, an outside advisor for the committee, and I've been working with, his name is Britt Lewis. I've been working with Britt for a couple of years now, and I would say Britt has found a way to explain things to me in a very tangible manner, and so I was hoping he could bring that expertise to the investment committee to help to, I guess, digest some information we get. So, Mr. Lewis, would you like to give any background or introduction of yourself?
Thank you, Regent Downs. I look forward to working with this committee. As Regent Downs said, my name is Britt Lewis. I'm originally from Gardnerville, Nevada. I went to the University of Nevada for my degree in economics. I have a longstanding relationship with ENSHI, and I'm very proud of the institution. Both my folks worked for University of Nevada, Reno, as well as Western Nevada College. I have been in the financial services industry for about 15 years now, primarily focusing on individual retirement planning. But I look forward to educating myself on institutional and endowment knowledge and providing education where I can.
Yeah. Thank you. That will move on to item number four. So we have our Cambridge Associates representatives here for item number four. And Wendy Walker and EJ, I mean, you going to help me with that? Okbeche. Gee, okay, thank you. I'm sorry if I said that wrong, but I guess we start with, you have a presentation for us?
Start on... For the record, E.J. Ogbeche, Cambridge Associates. Let us start in item number 4. We will start on page, let's start on page 7. Start on page 6. First, I will walk through a brief overview of the current market environment. I'll talk through some slides that we've prepared to give us an update on where we stand today. Heads up, the materials that we've prepared were prepared through the end of January, and there's been plenty of updates since then, so we'll provide as much context as we can. We'll also, we have action items for today, rebalancing in the operating fund. We'll provide an update to what those specific trades are as we walk through them, but high level, we're looking to rebalance back towards our portfolio long-term targets. And then we'll walk through, lastly, an example with one of the managers in the operating fund, a fixed income manager that's providing local impact here in Nevada. So we'll walk through an example of just how they're delivering that impact. So first, let me start. Actually, we'll start with the action items for rebalancing. I'll take those first. So on page 8 of your materials here, this is somewhat stale because, again, we've had activity since this was produced. So I'll provide an update as to what these transactions are. But for your information here, we're looking to trim from U.S. equities and trim from global equities, both asset classes that performed very well in 2025. And we'll be looking to add to the TIPS allocation as well as long-term bonds. And an update to those transactions. In the Metis transaction, we will still recommend trimming $20 million from the Metis U.S. index. We are updating our recommendation to trim Vanguard Developed Markets Index to $4 million from $6 million. And we are, addition to the Vanguard Vanguard TIPS position, this will now be $15 million as opposed to $17 million, what you see here. And then lastly, our add to long-term bonds, this continue to be $9 million, a $9 million add. And these transactions get us rebalance the portfolio, the long-term portfolio, towards its policy targets. If no questions, I will continue to our market environment. And I'll start there on page 13 of 53 in item number 4. Very high level here. Again, what we see on the left side of this page is through January, so not extremely relevant to date. But on the right side, you see in blue, equities have performed really strongly in 2025, as well as fixed income in yellow. But sort of the anomaly here, or greater dispersion that we've seen, is really in the real assets, precious metals in particular, gold and oil as of recent. We've seen that spike year to date. Global equities are not up 3%, as you would see on the left hand side. They're actually closer to flat, or about 1% up for global equities for the year, and about flat to down in the U.S. So slightly off from the performance that you've seen through January, signaling some choppier markets in February and March, as we saw the war in Iran start to take place at the beginning of March. So we've seen some choppiness, but the overarching there are no changes in terms of how we're managing client portfolios. We're still leaning into the diversification that we have in client portfolios to manage through this period. And despite the uncertainty, we still will lean into that, staying close to the policy targets and maintaining a diversified portfolio. But what you're seeing through the beginning of the 2026 thus far, you're not only do you see the divergence in some of the, again, the precious metals, but we're also seeing some of the rotation exist under the surface as well. Growth equities have been negative year to date thus far, whereas value has really started to catch a bid. And so we've seen that that rotation happening under the surface while the equity markets are still remaining flat. Let's jump to the next page. Really looking at economic activity, this remains solid. You'll see on the left-hand side, these are composite PMIs, so looking at services and manufacturing together, all telling a similar story that above 50, that it's still a positive or expanding economy globally. So that's a positive undertaking. And then on the right-hand side, you'll see GDP growth estimates really continuing to stay strong and even estimating more growth in the U.S. Than was projected in 2025. Moving on to the next slide, really looking at inflation and labor markets, the risks present themselves, but still we think these are manageable. Core CPI is elevated, but trending lower. The recent 3 months show sort of this the pressures fading, particularly UK, US, and the Eurozone. And I think from the labor perspective, unemployment is not yet alarming, which is we understand the current under what's going on with AI and some of the software companies and how that's causing more turnover and challenges in the labor market. So we do see those risks over the long term, but over the near term, still no uptick, larger uptick in unemployment. On the next page, briefly, this is
pardon me for 1 second, EJ.
Yes.
I had a request, just if you can keep stating what slide you're on so people can online can follow along too.
Yes.
Thank you.
So we are looking at page 16 now in the materials, 16 of 53, and this is on monetary policy and fiscal policy. Really, at the punchline here, monetary policy is nearing its end while fiscal policy is stepping up. So we see some of the rate cutting, the rate cutting cycle is getting to an end. On the left-hand side, we see not much planned in terms of rates, rate reductions going forward. So providing some sort of floor. but then the structural imbalance on the right, you'll see particularly in ex-US versus the US. I did want to touch on the next slide, slide 17. Sorry about that. This pertains to a lot of the challenges that we've seen in really public markets having such concentration in these hyperscalers. We've seen that about $600 billion of spending is expected in 2026 and over $700 billion in 2027. A lot of this is driving much of the investment that we see in this environment. And so it's also creating lots of fears as well with the exorbitant CapEx spend. Investors are worried or curious if this will how soon this will see hit the bottom line for many of these companies. And so some of the jitters that we've seen really are conveyed on the right-hand side, where you see this the CapEx spend as a percentage of their operating cash flow has just really ballooned. Let's jump to the next page, page 18. Sorry, let's jump to page 19. I'll end here. This is just looking at valuations across multiple asset classes. And so we can observe that we're in a period now where, you know, compared to valuations, long-term valuations, we're in a period where current assets are richly priced compared to their historical averages. And so that we just want to be eyes wide open and aware of that as we continue to rebalance and look for value in the portfolio. I will pause there for any questions.
Are there any questions from the committee? Any questions from, is there someone? No? Any,
yes, sure.
Yes, Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Chair. Earlier, the young man said we are taking out $2 million from here, $3 million from there, $6 million from here, all these different accounts. Where is that money going?
For the record, EJPHA, Cambridge Associates, on page 8, we detail the planned rebalancing. What we shared was that there were updates to the rebalancing. So the figures that you see on this page here in red and green were updated, and I can share those again if that's unclear.
They're all staying within the system accounts. We are reducing equities and adding to bonds. So it's just rebalancing between different system accounts as shown on that page.
Okay, thank you so much. Just, I don't understand these big amounts and money too good. So I was like, ooh, I hope that's going in my account. Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Regent Boylan. Please proceed.
Did we want to take a vote on the rebalancing recommendations?
Mr. Chair?
Is there any? Yes.
This is Regent Carvalho. I would like to move to approve the rebalancing based on Cambridge's recommendation.
Do we have a second to this motion?
Second, Regent McGrath.
Thank you. We have a motion to approve the recommended rebalancing from Cambridge and a second. So call for the vote. All in favor?
Aye.
I vote aye as well. Opposed? So that passes. Thank you. Would you like to continue?
So I'll briefly, before I touch on the manager in the operating fund, before I touch on the impact report in item 4, wanted to discuss quickly the performance and risk characteristics. You'll see on starting on page 21 of item 4. Just showing here, really the punchline, looking at the calendar year 2025, calendar year to date performance of 14.5% versus the 14% benchmark. Sort of the top line number there you see for 2025. Briefly going to the next page, I wanted to share the breakdown of the operating fund pools. So we have the long-term pool in green, the intermediate pool in blue, and then the short-term pool in yellow. This just shows over time how these accounts have fluctuated. Want to jump to page 23 very briefly. Looking at the far right, we show based on we have the short-term and intermediate pools that fluctuate depending on the level of cash. So this looks at an average 10-year asset allocation for the long-term pool. And we have a 3.9% target return, target real return for this portfolio. Currently today, where the allocation sits, you could expect a real compound return of about 4.2%. This comes with volatility, of course, and you'll see 7.7% for the 10-year average asset allocation, and 9.2 for assets today. 2020, let's move to page 24, and I just wanted to briefly point to that again, that 3.9% target return. While this is the target, our long-term target return that we'd expect in the portfolio over the very long term, the range of expected returns can vary over different time periods, and we reflect that here, such that shorter time periods can have a wider range of returns, of expected returns. And so while the median is still at 3.9% over each of these periods, 3, 5, 10, and 25 years, the range can get much wider, again, in shorter periods. On page 25, sort of exercise to show, essentially on the top half of the page, in the striped bars, we show the equilibrium return, so the long-term return that we would expect from each of these asset classes. In the solid bars next to them, this reflects our return to normal return. So if these long-term, based on where valuations are today, how would each of these asset classes revert to their mean? And so, for example, we show in U.S. equities down 3% is what we would expect over the next 10 years if U.S. equities were to revert to their average long-term return. And so we share what that would look like today, just so that we're, again, eyes wide open of the market risks that we face. Page 26, we also stress the portfolios over different in different market environments to see where that portfolio, again, how that portfolio would have performed in this time period, and we share each of those stress periods here as well. Just wanted to quickly go through that section again for everyone's benefit here, and before going to page 29, we'll start discussing RBC Access Community Investment Fund. So this is RBC Access Community Capital, RBC Access Capital Community Investing, excuse me. This is a manager in the operating fund that we have just under $25 million of exposure to. This is a manager that basically consists of federally guaranteed mortgage-backed securities and small business SBA loans as well. And so what they provide is investments with high-quality government guaranteed or agency-backed securities. So these are multifamily units. These are single-family units and affordable housing as well. On the next page, page 30, shows just how they allocate their portfolio. So overwhelmingly helping affordable housing and homeowners. Page 31 shows the geographic coverage of this portfolio. Nearly 80% of the portfolio is covering Clark County. Another nearly 20% or 10%, excuse me, is in Washoe County, and just over 5% is statewide. The next page, just very briefly, why it's important to serve these invest with these underserved communities, affordable housing, homeownership, and small business. These are areas that support these communities. So the next few pages, I wanted to go through a couple of examples that are in the portfolio that just bring again life to the investments that the system has. On page 33, we see an affordable housing, affordable homeownership investment. I wanted to call out here that this is 22 million of the portfolio invested, so most of the 25 million is in this investment. These are I want to point to the borrower profile on the right hand side. These are 100% low income, low to moderate income individuals, most of which are below the average, the area median income, and most of these are first-time, many of which are first-time buyers as well. On the next page, page 34, it's helpful to compare the portfolio to a sort of a benchmarked universe, and that's this Fannie Mae universe, where under sort of two pillars, you'll see that the portfolio is outperforming from this perspective of meeting the mission criteria metrics listed on the bottom right of the page. This is just showing that not only is nearly all of the portfolio meeting these mission criteria metrics, but the density or the number of criteria that are met are greater than the benchmark as well. So something to be proud of there. Very quickly on page 35, looking at nearly the $2 million of this money that's invested, these are with average annual income is $13,000 for these borrowers. 85% of the tenants are BIPOC. And most of these are female-led households, the majority of them have a family member with a disability in their household. So you really are supporting families in need with this affordable, with the multifamily affordable housing investments. And then the next couple pages give a couple of examples, and both in Las Vegas and Henderson. I won't go through those individually, but maybe let's land on page 38. Before I pause here, just looking at the balance that's invested with SBA loans, small businesses, a third of those are with veterans, and 100% of those are in with BIPOC demographics. I'll pause there for any questions or comments.
I guess I would just chime in that this was this section was in response to an IC question from the last meeting, so hope that this gives more context around this investment, and we're happy to address their questions.
Are there any questions from the committee? If not, are there any questions from any other regions? And hearing none, are there any questions from any advisors? Okay, we'll continue. Thank you.
So those were the prepared remarks that I had for the operating fund, item four.
Thank you. So if there are no other questions or discussion for item four, then there's no other action item on this, right? So we've already done the rebalancing. Okay. So I guess we'll move on then to item number five, Endowment Pool Performance, Cambridge Associates. So we're going to present a report on asset allocation and investment returns for the pooled endowment fund as of December 31st, 2025.
Certainly. Hi. For the record, Wendy Walker from Cambridge Associates. Why don't we start on slide 9 to look at performance. Similarly to the operating pool, this is performance as of December 31st. Calendar year 2025 was another very strong year in absolute terms. We can see that it's a 15.1% return, which is over 50% higher of long-term results for the last 50 years. So excellent. Excellent performance in absolute terms. We are lagging the policy benchmark by 200 basis points for the calendar year, largely because of the diversification in the portfolio. Folks will recall that this is a multi-asset class portfolio. We have not just public equities and fixed income as we have in the operating pool, which is intended to be a quite simple, passive, highly liquid portfolio. But in the endowment, because it's a perpetual pool, because we know that the demand, the liquidity demands on the pool will be less than 5% per year, we have flexibility to go into some alternative asset classes like hedge funds, like private equity, venture capital, private real assets. Those have been extremely additive to the portfolio over the long term, particularly in the context of market pullback periods or market volatility. But what we've seen over the trailing 3 years since folks may recall that in 2022, both equities and bonds sold off quite significantly for the first 9 months of the year. Starting in October 2022, the markets, public markets, have rebounded quite dramatically. And while our endowment portfolio added value during that market weakness in 2022, over the past 3 years, we've trailed the rebound. And maybe page 10 is a great visual illustration of this phenomenon. We can see that the total endowment is the blue line. We can see that was comfortably above the policy benchmark, the orange line on the top half of the page, for a large portion of the track record, and particularly wide in when the markets sell off. We can see the lines decline in 2022 with that market sell off. But subsequently, as the orange line, the policy benchmark, which is comprised exclusively of investable public market indices, as that has rallied from their deeper low, this portfolio has now gone upward, but up not as steeply upward as the policy benchmark. So as a result, at the bottom of page 10, we can see, and we parse out here, the total endowment versus the total Cambridge managed assets in green, just the value add, and this is a trailing five-year period that's memorialized in the investment policy statement. So our value add peaked. This is the difference. This is the endowment return minus the policy benchmark return. So that value added peaked when the market was selling off, arguably the most valuable time to add excess returns when returns are negative, because we're still continuing to support that quarterly payout. But since that time, the value add has declined. And again, this is almost exclusively a very, very large part is related to this mismatch between our private equity and venture capital exposure in the portfolio being benchmarked against public market indices. I'd also share the context that the vast majority of our clients are currently clients that have diversified asset classes in their portfolios. The vast majority are underperforming benchmarks in this recent environment for the same exact reasons. We're benchmarking to public markets. That's our opportunity cost. We have delivered and believe we can continue to deliver over the long run, that alpha, that excess return over the public market benchmarks. But in this recent period where public markets have been off to the races, at least through December 31st, we have not captured all of that upside. So that said, slide 11 gives some illustration. We broke out the 10 worst quarters in the last 10 years for public markets and the 10 best quarters over the last 10 years. And what we can see here is that in the worst quarters across the top part of the page, when when the All Country World Index, ACWI, was down on average 7% in those down quarters, this endowment portfolio was down only 3.7%. So just we're only down just over 50% of what the public markets are down. Public equity markets. On the flip side, at the bottom half of the page, during these really strong up markets, when the All Country World Index was up over 11%, our portfolio was up 7.4%. So we're capturing 2/3 of the upside in good markets, but we're protecting and only capturing 50% of the downside in weak markets. So there's an asymmetry there, which has that. That asymmetry between our upside capture and our downside capture has been what has allowed us to outperform the benchmarks over time, even though we're mindful that, yes, in these recent periods when markets have rallied so much, we are underperforming. Quick performance update relative, you know, all of these materials were as of December 31st. We had another strong month in January. And then February, we currently estimate that the portfolio was up 1.5% ahead of the benchmark. That was February, 1.5%, and that was ahead of the benchmark. For the month of March, since the war started in Iran and we've seen market sell-offs, we currently estimate that the endowment is down about 2%. And this is the type of environment where we would expect the diversification in this portfolio to really benefit results. So just wanted to share that updated context. A couple of other visuals, maybe page 12 looks on a risk return basis. And here we're measuring risk as the volatility of returns. There are other measures of risk that we're mindful as well. But here I think I'd like to point out the relationship between the total endowment, which is the orange dot on the upper left, to the policy benchmark. So we are delivering higher returns, that's the vertical axis, but also we're delivering those higher returns with lower volatility of returns. So on a risk-adjusted basis, it's a superior return. So being up in that Pacific Northwest region is where we like our portfolios to sit. So we're proud of these results. A few more points about private equity and venture capital in particular, as you know, this has been this mismatch against our public market benchmark has been the cause of a lot of the pain. If we look on page 13, we can see since our OCIO track record started, we've delivered 80 basis points of value add. And then if we deduct Cambridge's 30 basis point fee, we've delivered 50 basis points of value add over the policy benchmark. And a big percentage of that, what is private equity and venture capital? It's that and the marketable alternatives, which is our hedge fund program. These two diversifying alternative asset classes are the two largest contributors to our excess return, which we would expect. We want to be compensated for going into alternative assets. But then on page 14, when we parse out just the trailing year, and this is lagged as of September 30th because that's the most recent period where we have private investment results all reported. We can see that private equity and venture capital has detracted the largest amount. Again, this is this disconnect between the benchmark, public markets, and the exposure, private markets. Page 15 breaks out the last 6 years. And so we're feeling this pain over the trailing 3 years, 2023, 2024, and the first 9 months of 2025. Where we've lagged that public market rally that we looked at on the prior page. That's what we're feeling today with our trailing 3 year underperformance. But if we look back to 2020 to 2022, significant, significant outperformance. So again, and particularly in 2022, again, when public markets were down so much and our PEVC portfolio was slightly positive, this is the benefit of this type of allocation. I might, in the interest of time, jump ahead to slide 18, please. These are industry-wide results rather than NSHE-specific results, but I thought these visuals help to illustrate this phenomenon that we're in. In the upper left, these are rolling three-year returns. The blue line is private equity venture capital. And we can see there are some points of convergence historically, but for the vast majority of the time, the blue line, private equity venture capital, sits above that gray line, which is the public market equivalent index. The most recent 3 years has been a historic anomaly. We've never gone through a three-year period before where public markets have outperformed privates, but we can see that the blue line is turning positive there too. So we are seeing in the private equity venture capital markets some unthawing. Last year, 2025, was a record year for mergers and acquisitions. 2026 looked like it was setting up to be possibly a record year for initial public offerings of venture capital backed companies. Certainly the current volatility as a result of the Iran war might delay some of those IPO plans, but we're seeing some recovery in these markets compared to what we saw in 2023 and 2024. But I think the rolling 3 year line, I would contrast it to the rolling 10 year line across the bottom of the page, where at some points it's narrower than others, but on a rolling 10-year basis, and again, just as a reminder, this is a perpetual pool. We are 10 years is a short amount of time for a pool of assets that's intended to persist into perpetuity. So on a rolling 10-year basis, it's never even, these two lines have never even touched. Private equity and venture capital have delivered very comfortable excess returns. The final point I would make is on page 19, another new exhibit that we thought would be helpful for context. When we look at our peer universe, and we serve over 300 endowments as clients, and when we look historically about what's the difference between the top quartile performers on a 10-year basis, and then all the three other quartiles, one hallmark of the top performing institutions is that they tend to have higher allocations to private investments. This is where the value gets added for top performers on a long-term basis. So we can see that the average allocation for the most recent 10-year period, and our data here goes through 2024, the top quartile performers had about 35%, and the other three quartiles had about 16% in these asset classes. So again, this is what supports our conviction that our continuation in these private investments programs that we've built for NSHE will continue to pay off over reasonably long-term periods. And again, thinking about the time horizons, page 20, we have this in every book, every semi-annual book, where it's not anything new, but I think it just bears repeating that this is a perpetual pool. So we do monitor performance our team is looking at the portfolio on at least a weekly basis, sometimes more frequently, and making adjustments. But for performance measurement, we think it's really important to think over sufficiently long time periods to be meaningful. So we have our policy benchmark rolling 3-year periods. We are underperforming that benchmark today. But for, and that's shown on page 21, where we can see the blue line comfortably ahead of the benchmark for most periods, but has lagged the very, very sharp rally of public markets. But if we go to page 22, when we think about a rolling 5-year basis, and this is versus a simple 70-30 stock bond portfolio, comfortably ahead of that benchmark. Similarly, our absolute return target on page 23, which is our spending rate plus inflation, this was dragged down in 2022 by not only the market sell-off, but also the inflationary spike that we can see in the yellow line. But now we've rebounded back above that that return hurdle. So I will pause there to see if there's any questions about our recent underperformance and our longer-term outperformance.
Are there any questions from the committee members? I can't see people in Vegas. Oh, there we go. Any questions? No, any questions from any of the regents? Regent Gokuchia, did you have a question? I got to look like I had a message from you. No? Any questions?
No, not at this time. I'm sorry. I'm trying to get unmuted. Thanks, Chair Downs.
Oh, no problem. Any questions from any of the advisors? Yes, Mr. Lewis.
We could go back to slide 15 and just kind of review the, 2020, 2021, and then the difference starts to really change 2023, 2024, 2025, as you alluded to, Wendy. Is this due to leverage in these private investment portfolios and the kind of interest rate environment where these borrowing costs are becoming higher for these investments?
I think that's a part of it, yes. And it's not necessarily that these investments have leverage. In fact, our venture capital portfolio, which was the real driver of that insanely strong performance in 2021, that was these venture capital backed firms tend to not have any debt at all. They are they're cash generative. It's more that to get acquired, typically the acquiring company is often taking on debt to make an acquisition. Debt fuels the mergers and acquisitions industry. So in this higher interest rate environment, the prevalence of mergers and acquisitions, also of initial public offerings, really slowed down. There were just not a lot of exit opportunities. So what you'll note is that we logged that outperformance through 2021, and then performance has just been kind of flat. It hasn't declined, but there haven't been deals or catalysts to unlock additional value. And that's part of what we saw starting to change in 2025. It's still the deal volume is still lower than the peak that we enjoyed back in 2021. So I think the interest rate environment is a big part of the story, but it's not leverage within the companies themselves necessarily.
Okay. Sorry, I was going to add to that. EJ Beche, Cambridge Associates, for the record. Also in 2022, we had that big shift in regime in interest rates. So that was a big proponent of or a big headwind, rather, for many of the growth companies and private companies that are looking to exit in a sort of buoyant environment that sort of ended in 2022 when the interest rates sort of jumped from near zero to 4%.
And then do we have any insight on interest rate policy moving forward? Obviously, the most recent conflict may lead to an inflationary environment and continuing this interest rate period of higher for longer. Any insight, or I may ask for opinion?
Yeah, well, don't hold us to it. We're not economists, and we tend not to really make market predictions. But I think you'll likely be receiving today, midday, or maybe it's even come out. Our capital markets team was about to publish a new piece talking about exactly this, and I got off a call early this morning where they were talking about that the currently the worldwide, the expectation for potential further cuts have been deferred. The U.S. is now the only geography where markets are currently pricing in expectations for one remaining cut this year. And we would say at the margin, there's a pretty big band of uncertainty around that cut. The ECB and other Bank of Japan are now where there had been some forecasts of potential further cuts. Those have now been pushed out further. So certainly this the geopolitical events have pushed inflation expectations higher and are more likely to leave these leave rates higher for longer, as you said.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions from any of the committee or regents or advisors? Seeing none, go ahead and continue, please. Thank you.
Certainly. You know, I think the rest of the deck, a lot of section C is C and D are more leave behind reporting. Happy to touch on a couple of those slides if of interest, but I think the key takeaways are we are well within policy, as we always are. We have a compliance team that makes sure, and our team as well makes sure that we're always in compliance. And then we have some long-term risk and return expectations. And EJ, as he spoke through those in the operating pool, I think he explained the concepts very well. And I don't think I have anything to add there.
Thank
so,
you.
Yeah.
So I guess that concludes item five, I assume. So then item six, we have the endowment pool performance comparison of INSHI, UNLV, and UNR. So we want to look at that. And these are all informational items. So,
Chris Vitone, for the record,
yes.
I think just to introduce this item, this is a regular item on your agenda. As you're aware, Cambridge manages the NSHI held endowment that holds assets on behalf of all the institutions, but institutions that have a separate foundation also hold endowment assets, and UNR and UNLV have the largest of those institution held separate foundation endowments. And so this report provides a comparison of the performance of those UNLV and UNR foundation held endowments to the NSHI pool. And I'll ask Cambridge to walk through the comparison.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. For the record, Wendy Walker of Cambridge Associates. So I think the key takeaway here, nothing earth-shattering since the last time we reviewed this at the last meeting. You know, we have three pools of relatively similar size. We do see differences in asset allocation, which makes sense since the spending rate and for these three pools are a little bit different. And there are also just different investment approaches that I think can very much make sense. And I think the returns that we see in section C, for example, especially over the long-term period, the 10 years ended June 30th, 2025, these returns are all within 40 basis points of each other. So different approaches, different asset allocations, but all seem to, you know, from my, I don't have insights into the UNLV and UNR returns, but we're coming, or portfolios, but we're coming out in very close shape to each other. So I think all three of these institutions are executing on their mandates and don't have any other observations.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee on item six here for the endowment pool comparisons? Any questions from any other regents? Any questions from any of the advisors? No? I guess seeing none. Does that conclude this item? Okay. Well, and then after item six, we move on to the new business. Are there any new business items anyone would like to see going forward?
Chair Downs, this is Amy Carvalho.
Yes. Yes.
I probably should have brought this up when we were discussing the operating pool performance, but I do wonder if Cambridge is able to provide some information regarding the higher education index, the HEPI, for us. I don't know if that would be helpful in this committee. I do know that, you know, that sometimes that looks different than CPI. So, and I'm not sure if that's appropriate, but I wanted to just ask. Thank you.
So would you like to see that as a future item, or are you asking to reopen the earlier item on the...
No, we don't need to go back to item number 4, but if possible, if Cambridge can include information on the HEPI on future reports, that might be helpful for us. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other agenda item requests?
Maybe just an information item that I failed to point out. At the last meeting, there had also been a request from one of the IC members to understand more about the underlying holdings within the operating fund. So just wanted to flag that on the rebalancing page, there are live links where any IC member or anyone else can click through to that mutual fund, and then there are lists of all of the holdings, just to provide that greater transparency.
Okay. Thank you. If there are no other future agenda items for new business, we'll move on to item number 8, public comment. Is there any public comment at GBC?
Good morning. No public comment at this time.
Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Las Vegas?
None in Las Vegas.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't see any public comment here in Reno. SCS, is there any public comment on the phone?
There's no callers at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. And with that, we will adjourn the meeting at 9:57 a.m.